now time to think outside the box of what we've always known.
I myself will tend my sheep and have them lie down, declares the sovereign Lord.
I think that's a profound turning point in somebody's relationship with God.
And our hope in starting this was that this would become an ever-expanding conversation.
Just two real guys talking about life. That's a nice tagline.
I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Brad Cummings.
And welcome to another edition of The God Journey. The God Journey, take 67.
We're back.
We've had a hard time today. We've already done one podcast that didn't work, and now we're going to try another one. And we're just freshly back from Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
A little movie moguling.
You didn't like going down there. You said, I'm not doing this again.
You know, I'm not impressed.
You can buy a humbug on.
I'm not impressed by a lot of that garbage, and I'm really not impressed by the traffic between here and downtown Los Angeles.
Traffic didn't work for you.
It's kind of a pain in the neck. But we've had
opportunities. You had your iPod. We at least were aware of it.
We knew it was a horrible traffic. What are you talking about?
It's L.A.
You wake up every morning, it's horrible traffic. Anyway, some of the folks from the Prince Caspian movie coming up wanted to talk to us a little bit. And we tied them in with some folks we know on the movie deal, and then we went out to Santa Monica. And
we didn't use our own plane like the people we met.
We had some people flying on their own jet. Well, Windblown's a new company. It takes a while to get to jet.
We don't have our corporate jet yet.
I can get you one.
You can be the pilot.
I can stop by Toys R Us and get you one.
I have that plane. I like that. But there's no passengers. I can't fit in there.
Believe me, there's nothing harder than meeting at an airport and watching those little planes come in and take off and come in and land.
Especially if you're like a pilot guy.
Oh, I know. I miss that so much. That's one of those things in your life. You just miss a ton, but it's not for me right now.
Well, as soon as I have the corporate jet, I'll let you fly it.
We had a great time talking about the movie and how it's coming together. It seems like God's bringing some wonderful folks together with some similar hearts, and we'll just see how that unfolds for the Shack. So that'll be fun. And on the publishing side, have we made a decision yet?
Let me check. Nope.
Okay, I'm waiting for you, so I should hurry up. No, those of you that are waiting.
We have leanings, but I don't think we've pulled the trigger on exactly what to do yet.
Well, we sure hope we'd pull the trigger by now, but we're still going to get some information in that we don't have, and when we get all that, we'll try and pull the trigger here.
But you know, this whole experience, what's really exciting to me is I feel so profoundly cared for by the Lord. You just look at the doors that He's opening, the people that He's sending. We haven't had to go knock down anything.
No, we haven't even had time to knock on a door.
Well, it's like, this is completely unheard of. And you're just going like, Lord, this is pretty outrageous that You are allowing this kind of favor and this kind of opportunity for those doors just to open up. And you're just going like, wow, God, it's just exciting to watch what He's doing.
That's a lot of fun. And we heard this from Ian Australia about our podcast last week. And I really liked what he said. He talked about putting people on pedestals, which we talked about just briefly. And he said this. He said, someone said something years ago that has made sense to me. When you make heroes of people in the sense of putting them on a pedestal, you take away both their freedom and yours.
Oh, that's good.
Isn't that a great statement?
That's good. You also ruin the whole capacity for relationship.
You destroy it. Yeah, but that's part of that whole loss of freedom. And you put somebody in a little hero, celebrity, man of God box. And you've really ruined any hope of them getting to be free to be who God's made them to be. And you, any hope of relating to them or even having their life be an example for yours because you've got them in a different place. Yeah. So that was good send-in, Ian. Appreciate that very much.
So we have the hero from up north, the guy that has power over fog.
We're not alone today. He has no power over fog.
No, he doesn't. His fog seems to undo him a lot.
You just waited out till April. No, this is Dave Coleman, who's been with us on the podcast before, who's feeling a little neglected because we spent a minute and a half talking with him. Hi, Dave.
Well, it's all right.
Are you going to get over it?
No, I'll live through it.
We've been trying to get Dave in to do some podcasting with him for about 3 months, and every time we found a date we could all work with, weather prevented it. Either fog in the valley or snow on the grapevine to keep him from getting down to L.A.
Do you live in Sleepy Hollow? What's the deal with that?
It's just we're a lot slower than you guys down here with your jet airplanes and your freeways. And
no, we're only coveting them. We don't have them yet.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, we're just coveting them. If we would have had them, we'd have flown you down. It would have been easier. We could have skipped everything. Of course, the fog would have been complicated maybe getting out of that. But
you can do it. You're a pilot.
Anyway, for those of you who don't know Dave, Dave was my co-writer on the So You Don't Want to Go to Church Anymore book, which is getting some fresh legs off the streaming off the Shack a bit.
This is one of your friends who's my favorites.
Of all my friends?
I think so. I
got other friends who are hurt now.
Maybe they'll get over it.
Why'd you have to put him on a pedestal?
I'm not putting him on a pedestal. I'm enjoying the conversations we get, so let's let him talk.
Go, Dave, go.
Actually, I need some help from you, Dave. Those of you who don't know, Dave was a Lutheran pastor for how many years? 15, 20?
18, 20, yeah.
Yeah, 18, 20 years.
Wow.
And left that 30 years ago or more, long time ago. Got kicked out, yeah, defrocked. Defrocked, taken away. Anyway.
Did you get kicked out?
No, I left peacefully.
Okay. We need to learn something.
I guess, yeah. How'd you pull that off?
Well, I just went to the bank and grabbed the money and left.
Okay. This podcast is going to take a different turn than I thought it was going to take. Okay. Is that how you want to leave it?
That's fine with you.
That's fine with you.
I know the truth hurts, but it's...
I was thinking deep and thin. Whee! Far from... Anyway, I need your help. I'm actually going to be this Sunday morning speaking in a Lutheran fellowship back in Connecticut. This is the letter I got. It says, because I wrote him and I said, do I need a tie, coat? You know, what do I need for Sunday morning? Because I don't usually wear that. Yeah, that's what he said. He said, well, as far as Sunday morning attire, well, I'm sorry to say, this congregation is one of those where all the worship leaders wear dresses. Eyeshadow is optional. Those remember that little
He's
story.
He's been listening.
But we do the dress thing. I was recently listening to one of your older podcasts where you make the comment about everybody up front at some congregations wearing dresses, even the little boys lighting the candles. Well, this is one of those congregations. We're Lutheran. And like most Lutherans, we look like Catholics at worship services, somewhat traditional in form, but we hope more relational in substance. So,
awesome. We got to take a picture. This is Wayne in a dress. This is good.
I'm hoping we're still talking robes here, but I'm never sure. You know, people leave weird things in my rooms when I travel, so I'm game.
Well, that'll be good.
It could be interesting.
Careful of the draft.
You want to give me any advice about this, Dave? You've been up front in a dress. How's it work? Is that before you took the money?
Oh, brother.
We are irreverent, aren't we? This will actually be airing while I'm there. So
oh, perfect.
This will be a bit of a problem.
If you want to know more about Wade,
would you stop it?
No, I doubt it. Since you're not an ordained Lutheran clergyman, whether you would even wear the robes,
good.
Just the suit.
Good. Thanks, Dave.
He doesn't get a dress?
No.
You have to be official.
I have to be official. I'm not sanctioned.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my gosh.
You can't get the funny hats and the long dresses and...
Hats, too?
I don't know what the Lutherans do. They wear a lot of the little funky hats like the...
No, Lutherans
don't. No, they don't wear the hats, but they wear the...
Makes the Pope look like a screwdriver when he wears one.
Yeah.
And by the way, he's in the country, so welcome to our country.
Oh, that was wonderful, Henry. He looks like a screwdriver. I've never heard that.
That's what reminds... I'm sorry. Anyway, maybe we'll get here. Dave's been a wonderful influence on my life in some ways. He didn't teach me the take the money and run approach to church departure. But we have talked a lot in the past about religion and how it kind of undermines what God's really doing. And I got this from a good friend of mine, Kent, back in the Midwest the other night. And I thought, boy, this would be good maybe to launch us into what we're going to talk about. So, Wayne, I wish you'd been here tonight to hear the things I've heard tonight in phone conversations. I had conversations with friends and family that are so caught up in the religious system, and their lives vacillate between denial, to make themselves feel better, and outright fear, panic, shame, guilt, and feelings that God has let them down, and then the other group of friends and family that have seen religion for what it is and have let it go and are in the process of being freed and are finding deeper and deeper levels of freedom as they go. The first group looks at the second group and speaks of the reality of something going on in their lives, and at the same time will say we are all nuts, and we have to be wrong. None of these friends and family that are caught up in religion are experiencing it working for them, but they just keep on doing it with all these little examples in front of them. You can imagine, I've been a little ticked off at religion tonight. Kent, I share your frustration. I get ticked off at religion, too.
Why are we so susceptible to that?
Dave's the expert on religion. I had more respect for him until I found out how he left. But Dave, you talk a lot about what religious people, how they respond, how they act. Does Kent's letter, do you understand what Kent's saying?
Oh, I certainly do understand it. And I think, you know, if something isn't done, frankly, we're simply going to lose what we know as the church today because people are becoming increasingly frustrated. And when there's more tension in the society that we live in, it's going to spill over into the church. And if the church adds to it and compounds it, it's really going to be a sad situation. I think in order to answer the question, though, we need to really go back to the beginning to understand what God's intention is. It seems like, you know, so often the church is like just a bunch of football players wanting to do their own thing, running here, running there, and so forth. But it's not going to work until they understand what the coach's intention is, what plays he wants to run, and what his whole purpose is. And if you can...
And I would think most churches feel like they're teaching that.
Yeah, I know they do. Well, let's look at it for a minute. You know, way back in the beginning, God said he's going to create a man in his image. What is the image? It is the likeness of another in attitude, not necessarily in the way they look physically, but the characteristics of what makes their personality what it is. So God was saying, in effect, and he said it to not only to Adam, but he also sent it, you know, to Abraham in Genesis, you know, I will bless you so that you will be a blessing. And then he went down the road and chose this little group of Israel. And what was the whole purpose? Simply to show to the world, to the universe, if you will, that God is a God who has ideas that work. He wanted that demonstrated on this planet, on this earth. This is why he called the people together. This is why he called the group together, why he wanted to lead them into the promised land. And it's interesting in Numbers 12, 13, and 14, what really happened. They're out in the wilderness and for a little while, and one day he said, you know, send them over. You're about to go into the promised land to be this blessing to many nations.
Kill a few on the way in. That, yeah. That was kind of the problem.
Yeah. But the whole idea was a demonstration of what happens when people trust God with their lives and allow God to do what he wants to do with them. And what happened was that they sent the spies over and they all came back and said, you know, the Sunday school story of how, hey, we're just a bunch of grasshoppers compared to those guys, except for Caleb and Joshua. So God says to Moses, look, I've had it with this little group of ragtail people. I'm going to wipe them all out and we'll start again and do it. And Moses pleads for their lives and he says, no. And God responds in a very interesting, to me, one of the key verses in the entire Bible when he says, all right, Moses, I'll go along with this. But Moses, one day my glory will cover the earth. In other words, what is glory? Glory is the demonstration of the essential characteristics of who God is. If we look at our goal, then, it is the same as it's always been through the Bible, and that is for us to be a demonstration of who God essentially is. And what happens to us when we allow God to be the God that he wants to be? To me, this is the key to it, because anything else will simply fall short and we'll get all tied up. We'll be like a bunch of ragtag football players running all over, some here, some there, some kicking, some throwing, and so forth, unless there is the understanding of God's goal, not our goal, not the church's goal, but God's goal.
But don't our religious institutions teach that exact thing? If you do what we're saying, then God's glory is going to be in the earth, and that's the goal of everything, and stop living for yourselves. Do what we want you to do. Isn't that part of the rhetoric? Or are you talking about something different than that?
Something different than that, because if we look at the very basic concept of where we're at, we're told by the Bible very clearly that we have all sinned and come short of the glory of God. And that simply means, if we look at the word sin, sin means, above all else, control.
Whoa, unpack that a minute. I don't think that's a natural place people are going to go with you. Sin is about control.
Sin basically is control. We in the church have learned that, you know, not to smoke, chew, or run around with girls who do as being...
I didn't get that in Sunday school.
As being sin. Well, I did when I met my wife, and I knew I had a problem there.
Okay. I can be snarky. What's wrong with this group this morning?
But sin always talks about, in the church, doing bad things or not doing good things. Vacation Bible School, we learn not to throw rocks at the garbage truck and so on and so forth. And all of these things have basically stuck with us. And so,
well, there's bigger things, too, like don't lie, don't steal, and don't murder.
Yeah.
And don't commit adultery.
Sure. Yeah,
I just saw the Ten Commandments movie, Brad, so I'm well aware of that. Yeah, I got all down again.
Yeah, but that's not the very basic nature of sin. That may be symptoms of sin, but it's not the whole concept of what is basically wrong with us. We want to be in control. We want to take control. When Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, Satan came to him and he said, look, take control. Take control. Use this. Satisfy that want or that desire and so on and so forth. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that because that would not be a demonstration of who God really is. Because when Jesus came toward the end of his life and the disciples, and he told the disciples he was going to leave them, they popped up and said, okay, we really don't understand that, but before you do go, we don't know where you're going, but before you go, show us the Father. And Jesus simply said, he who has seen me, who has seen the Father. In other words, Jesus was simply saying, I am the living demonstration of who the Father, who God really is. And his attitude towards you and his love for you. Because they were always getting involved with religious things. For example, they're walking down the road into Jerusalem. The Jerusalem Day School lets out. All the kids run up to Jesus because he was an attractive guy, a friendly guy. He went to a lot of parties. He was at peace. He was relaxed. But the disciples, on the other hand, said, look, get away from there. Get those kids out of here. Don't pick them up. Take them. Move them away. We're coming in. And Jesus simply said, look, you know, hey, this is what the kingdom of God is made of. It's made up of little children who love me, who want me to come and play with them in the sandbox and all of these things that kids love to do. And what we need to see is not a bunch of people in the church who think they can do things right, who do this and do that and so forth. And all of these things, in essentially, I suppose, have their place. But are they really the demonstration of who God is? Because we have a tendency to elevate ourselves when we try to do things. That alienates God, that alienates people, and that alienates one another. Because it's merely a control factor to get attention, to get look, to be able to put more scalps on the wall, so to speak. I remember a few years ago,
Well, you tend a pretty rough place, then. What do you took the money and ran? Scalps on the wall?
Well, when we, you know, we have, basically, in that act, and that is, and says, what I'm thinking of is a lot of churches are what I call P.S. churches. They'll go through the whole sermon and, you know, do this and do that, and you should do or you shouldn't. And then at the end, someone will say, oh, and P.S., if none of you know Jesus as your Lord and Savior, come up here and we'll talk to you about it. And, you know, to me, that's the sum and substance of what Christianity is. It's not an addendum, but we want you to do that. We have no way of really dealing with that or explaining that to you, but we just want your name on the wall. And what I'm meaning here is that somehow we in the church have got to get beyond, you know, our programs to see what God's program is.
Is that possible in a religious environment? I mean, I think the whole nature of religion itself is to give us another excuse to try and take control. It doesn't challenge that sense of I'm at the center of my life. It gives us another excuse to get there and to do it with God supposedly smiling over our shoulders, saying, yeah, you're working harder than the rest of them. You're my good kid.
Yeah, but the way we're made, that even though we do that and even though we do it well, we always have this underlying fear of who are we really?
Yeah, there's no rest that comes out of that. Even if you perform well, at some point you end up, it's like running out of gas.
That's right.
You can put together a couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months of great string of good behavior, but then it seems like always, you know, we call it our little backsliding, and it's like somehow I don't see the freedom in that.
There is no freedom, because if you base your faith in God on a cause and effect relationship or doing good deeds and not doing bad stuff, then you get into this, you know, well, if I did this and did it right, why is this happening to me?
When bad things come
up. Yeah. And good things should happen to good people. I remember in working at hospice, whenever we would get a new patient, the nurse would go in and take all the information. And there was a place on there to write their religious preference. And whenever they came back and said it's, you know, it's Protestant or Presbyterian, Lutheran, Catholic, or whatever it happens to be, I just kind of shuddered, because I knew what I was waiting for, because I would go in there and sure enough, in one way or the other, they would say, why is this happening to me? Why did I get this tumor? Why do I have this heart problem? Why am I dying? You know, after all, I you know, why is God punishing me?
Well, the Christian theology we've taught really does put a conflict on people when bad things happen to who we think are good people. I mean, that's the big discussion that goes on even in the culture fairly broadly, is because the whole Deuteronomy idea, if you do good, I'll bless you, I'll do blah, blah, blah. And if you do bad, then the enemy will come and the pestilence will come and things will be wiped out. So what switches that? Because I think most Christians uncritically really believe that that's true. The better I can be, the more God is endeared to make my life better, to bless me. You're talking about something other than that.
I certainly am, because to me, when you become a Christian, you have to understand what it really means, and that is that the death and resurrection and the ascension of Christ has freed me. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And Jesus said, then on top of that, I'm going to leave you my peace. So a Christian is one who should simply be a relaxed individual, be at peace. His guilt over the things in the past, his shame and so forth, has all been taken care of on the cross.
Whoa, okay. Whoa.
I don't know a lot of those.
Whoa, where's that being taught?
Well, that's what I'm talking about. We've got to have settings for people to come and have their lives interpreted as to what God is doing in his involvement with him. Paul says very, very frequently in all of his epistles that God is at work within you, both to will and to do for his good pleasure, not for ours. So we have to understand, well, what does that mean? I thought God was supposed to work for my pleasure. I thought he was supposed to make me comfortable. I thought if I came to church, I could learn these five principles and I would get this and get that. But the hardest thing for us to realize as Christians is that it's not about us. It has nothing to do with us, because it's all about Jesus, through whom, to whom, and for whom are all things. It's not, you know, for me, to me, and through me. God exists for me. It doesn't work that way.
I think a lot of people have a disconnect there, because, you know, I think so oftentimes the sales pitch for Christianity is, you know, come and we'll basically teach you, you know, how to follow God and your life will be blessed. I do think a lot of what is given is that, you know what, do you know where your eternal destiny is? I mean, all these things, it's more like what I get out of it. It's a sales pitch, and if you come to Jesus, you know, things are going to be great. And I see a lot of people coming, but you see a lot of disillusionment of just going like, well, it doesn't seem to work for me. They're trying to work a system to get a result, and I don't see a whole lot of peace. I don't see a whole lot of, quote, freedom.
Well, I don't see a lot of people coming in the door saying, listen, what we want you to do is rest in the forgiveness and cleansing love of God and let him change you.
That is not what we start there.
I mean, if the whole deal is, I mean, religion and relax to me never goes in the same sentence, even though Jesus and relax does, even though the reality is until we do know that Father cares about me and has my best interests at heart that get swallowed up in his purpose, then I can't even begin to go on this journey. Then I've got to protect me. I've got to control the outcomes in my life. I've got to control people around me to make me happy. And religion gives me the excuse to do it and gives me a forum to do it, quite frankly.
Yeah, and that's basically the background from the book, because, you know, when you look
which
at...
Which book is this?
The Jake book.
The Jake, okay.
Yeah.
When sure which one you're talking about?
Yeah, because people literally, they get tired of this. They get burned out about it. And either than that, they just find that, hey, there's something wrong here. It finally dawns on them as they begin to look at this deeper, you know, why is it when I go to church I feel manipulated, I feel used, and so on and so forth? instead of understanding what God is doing in my life. You know, what is God saying to me when I have this problem? Basically, when we have problems, it's simply because if we're anxious and so forth, it's because we're trying to control things in our life. And God is saying, in essence, look, I'll take care of that for you. You just let it go. And to me, it's trying to help people understand that the Christian life is a series of one loss after the other. He who loses the most wins. That's what Jesus said. He who loses his life for my sake will
find it.
Find it. Yeah. And we look at this, but yet somehow that really doesn't compute. We're so keyed into this control thing that, you know, it just goes beyond us.
Well, it seems like there's two things you talk about from people. For one, if you can make religion work for you, I mean, you get to have control over other people. So you get to manipulate that environment. Then people really love religion at that level. For most people, the vast majority of people, trying to somehow control God by their performance, what you're just talking about now, they realize very quickly that doesn't work. As good as I can try to be, God's not coming through with the goodies that I think or I feel like I've been promised he should come through. And so for some people, that environment works and they use it to manipulate people. For other people, they're the manipulated ones, or they're the ones that feel like never good enough. And they live, you said once to me, you think 90% of people who attend church on Sunday morning live with a resident anger towards God. Do you still believe that?
I certainly do. And over the fact that if they don't attend church, they're afraid of what something worse might befall them.
So another reason to go is because, boy, that's at least how you get minimal goodies. Is that it? Or I'll get really punished if I'm not here?
Well, yeah. Most people look at church as the irreducible minimum. In other words, what do I have to do to stay out of hell? Because if I don't repent, I'm going to hell. You know, this is the way it's preached so often. Jesus never said that. He didn't say repent or you're going to hell. He said repent because there's something better here. The kingdom of God is here. Something I really want to share with you.
So at the very beginning, we're not helping people either A, learn to relax in God's reality, God's provision, God's purpose, and B, we're not teaching them how to learn to interpret their life in the midst of God's love. We're actually teaching them if things are bad in your life, it's because you're not working hard enough. It really is God's. I think at the moment of greatest struggle, people feel the most distance from God. I wouldn't have this cancer, this unemployment, this whatever, if God hadn't already abandoned me. So you start out in trouble at a distance from the one who wants to be in that mess with you.
Right.
Which I think is part of what we loved about the shack. It put God right at the crisis point of pain, not safely off in the distance saying, well, you crawl out of there someday, I'll be here for you.
Mm-hmm.
How do we help change that thinking? I mean, we're talking about a major systemic way that Christianity as religion has operated for the last couple thousand years, where it is about performance.
So much of how Christianity gets presented, it doesn't seem to be all that different from your average self-improvement program. It's like if you can master these principles, then the likelihood is, you know, it's going to go well for you. And when it doesn't go that way, you do get this buildup, this resentment of, God seems to be holding out on me. Why isn't he blessing me like he does? Or if you see somebody does get blessed, but they're not behaving like they should, that's a profound disconnect because it's like, that's not fair. And so we do. We look through this paradigm of, you know, I want a blessed life. None of this seems to be about how marvelous Jesus is.
Right.
And none of this seems to be, you're talking about where he's central. It's not about me. It's about him. You were mentioning verses where Paul was talking about, it's not my life. It's Christ's life being formed in me. It's his living his life in me. I do think for so many people, that's just a disconnect. It's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have any experiential dynamics of another guy's life being inside me.
Right.
And so all they've known is I'm trying really hard and I'm tired.
Yeah.
And disappointed.
But they keep going.
Because they're supposed to.
Right.
Oh, boy, this is bad. I've got this. You sent me this article a couple months ago, and we'll post it up on the website so folks can read the whole thing. But some quote you had here said, years ago, I found myself totally absorbed as a pastor in keeping the machinery going, doing everything that needed to be done, from mowing the lawn to sweeping up the rice in the parking lot on Saturday so the matrons of the parish would not slip and fall as they came to service in the morning. Admittedly, and I shamefully I might add, the thought of a present Jesus in all his glory was not the highest of my priorities. To survive, I had been trained, was to lay on the guilt and to say indirectly, if not directly, to the membership that they'd better get their act together if this church was going to continue. Just like the majority of clergy today who are worried about job security more than anything else. The diabolical thing about this is that it worked. If you threaten people, especially with God's disfavor, you cause them to be afraid of possible eternal consequences, and this results in turn in causing anger at God.
That's right.
So you were part of this.
Oh, yeah.
I was part of this.
Oh, sure.
How do we, boy, because now it comes down to is we're not going to be able to fix that whole thing out there, but what do we begin to say and do and live differently that causes people to walk away from this false attempt to get God's life and learn how to really live in it, the reality of it?
I think just on an individual basis, this is the way Jesus worked. He worked basically one at a time, talking to people, and it's been a miracle to me. Just within the last 2 months, not only with the emails that we get about the book of people who identify what the abuse that's gone on in the church, but I made contact with about five people, clergy in one way or the other, who have been asked to leave and so on and so forth, or who have been burned out. And we just talk and we share, and doors are opening. To me, it's just, it's not a movement. It's not something we can, come up with and say this is the national way. But I think it can only be done by example. Just, loving each person. And someone wrote, I don't remember who it was, but they said, everybody you meet, treat them as though they are an abused and broken child. And if we can use that approach in life, then people will be attractive. I had a situation not too long ago about, I was teaching a class and talking with people in the medical profession, and afterwards, one of them came up to me, and just a dear lady, and she had been divorced and remarried, and she said, well, what's gone wrong? What happened in my relationship? And I just sat down, and she was a member of a church, and I said, I'll just be honest with you. And I said, the whole reason for your divorce is what I would call control. You tried to control him, he tried to control you. And she jumped up out of the chair, and she said, that's it. You're exactly right. They did a study not too long, well, it's been about 5 years ago, where they asked 500 people who do marriage counseling in our country, all kinds, clergy, psychotherapists, and social workers, and so forth, what is the main cause for divorce in our country? Why do we have this high divorce rate? And they all wrote back and simply said, control. Control. We get tired of being controlled, and so we find someone who we think is not going to control us, and the cycle just keeps going over and over. So it's true not only in society, it's true in the church, and until that cycle is broken, it will just go on, and people will be hurt, they'll be used and abused, and so forth.
See, I think people hate control, but I think the whole fear dynamic is what causes people to reach for it. It's if I don't feel like I'm okay, or I'm somehow in my insecurity of what's going on, you just put someone in the passenger seat of a car on a mountain twisty road, and most of them are like, I'd sooner be behind the wheel. So I mean, the control, the need for it, the knee jerk response to grab it. That seems to be so ingrained in us, to tell someone to not do that. That's all. I think there's just a disconnect for a lot of folks. What do you mean not do that? That's how do I not
control?
Do that?
Yeah,
it's like that. That is an instinct. mm-hmm. of self-preservation that they immediately reach to. How do you disconnect that in someone?
It's a long, slow process, but in every situation, in every conversation, you have to say, in essence, God, I want you to be in control. You know, we sometimes feel it has to come out from us. And you know, like the disciples were told, look, I'll give you the very words you need to say. All you do is be available. And this is the whole concept of what Christian life is all about, is just being available. With hospice, the thing I had to do before I would go in to see a terminal patient in their home, whenever I would pull up, I would have to just stop before I went in and clear my mind. You know, what was I supposed to bring home? What groceries was I supposed to pick up? What paper did I have to write? And just say, Lord, help me focus on this person who obviously is abused, who obviously needs healing. And just say, you're in control. And I want you to use me to say your words of life and meaning. And there were situations that I were in almost daily that, and I tried to take control of the situation and tried to, you know, read them the 5 or 15 or 35 spiritual laws, I would have killed them. But by just being what God wanted me to be available, I still goofed it up many times. The me, got in the way. But basically, that's what we have to be able to say. God, you're in control of this. Use me. I trust you to use me in this situation.
And part of that would necessitate a relationship that allows that to happen. I heard what you said earlier about the marriage and control. And I think one of the things that's so endearing of what we call people falling in love, that you find somebody who loves you and cares about you as a person, and most people get married with that idealistic star in their eyes. And what they found is this real attraction of love, which is the freedom to be me and not be controlled. And then I wonder if we talk about falling out of love is when people in that relationship decide my personal well-being rests on this person doing what I want them to do. And now instead of just loving and caring about them, I begin to take control over them and they begin to try and take control over me. And that's why we get to this whole divorce situation. There's something about love that doesn't need to control, genuine love.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if the world really knows it well. I don't know that I knew it well for most of my Christian journey, because what I was taught to love was basically how to manipulate people to do what I thought was best for their lives. That's what love meant.
Right.
And in a religious way, it just allowed me to take more control over people's lives. But on this journey for me, it's the more I've become convinced of this Father's love for me.
That's right.
In whatever circumstance I'm in, it doesn't even matter now what I'm going into, whether it's movie meetings yesterday or decisions about this or that. My whole heart is, Father, I know you care about this situation more than I do. I know you have a purpose and a glory that's beyond me. And I know I don't have a clue as to what that is.
Well said.
So how it is that I just am available enough to walk through this moment with you so that something wonderful in your heart can happen and it doesn't have to please me. And that's just a different deal for me, because I think most of this was, the religion was how to use God to get your pleasure meter pushed to the limit. Instead of, no, when I disconnect from my investment in it, then God, what are you doing? I think it makes it easier to hear him, easier to see what he's up to, and easier to go along with it. Relaxed again, I guess.
Yeah, I think the reason it's so challenging for folks is I think all we've known is activity. Always known as sort of our effort. And if you're not secure in the fact that God is an actual person who's with me and is at work, you sort of, if I don't do anything, nothing's going to happen. And I think for a lot of people, it's like, that just seems like a huge leap to go like, inactivity is scary, because how will anything positive come out of that? And I think it's only those people that have come to a place where, you know, they've supposedly shot all the bullets they had and realized, I don't have anything else that I can do to make this happen. It's only in the awareness that more activity for me isn't going to bring this about, that it seems like people start to become available for God to be able to penetrate into that and for them to learn that he is there.
Particularly,
he is at work.
Particularly the activity that's performance-based. I mean, I think love's very active. When you're out in the world doing what you said, divesting myself of my agenda, Dave, and then living in the reality of how does God make himself known to this person, that's an incredibly active way to live, but it's not activity-based. It's not, I've got to do all these things to keep God on my side, which is exhausting.
Yeah, and I think most people are fed in most, I think, religious structures is, here's that list of things that are would be good for you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then it does tend to applaud and approve of those that are doing them the best. We sort of put them up front like, here's the example of the great life. I mean, that's the testimony.
Absolutely.
It's like, you know, I did this and that, and then I got all these goodies, and it's like, you too can have this. And you're just going like, I'm not really sure that's the Christian life you're talking about.
Right.
But that's the testimonies not. That get paraded. And you're just going like, I think it's giving people just a false notion that this is not, I mean, I think you said earlier, this is not about me.
Mm-hmm.
Coming to Christ, being a follower of Christ, is not about, gee, what do I get? It's a whole different life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to keep talking about this with Dave. We're running out of time. We're going to hold him over and do another podcast with him. There's something you say here, interesting, provocative question in the course of your art. You said, does the church attract angry people, or does the church produce them? Interesting in terms of, I'm sure, religion, not just church, but... Dave, thanks for joining us. We'll hold you over and do it again next week. How about that?
Good to see you guys again, too.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
Thank you for traveling with us on The God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com.